morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. My name is Dr. Miriam Nighan, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area, on HD Radio, worldwide on www.nyuirish.net/radiohour, and on irishradio.com. So, whether you're here in New York City, or in Ireland, or somewhere else further afield, sit back, relax, agus fáilte isteach. For those of you who don't already know, Glucksman Ireland House is NYU's Centre for Irish and Irish American Studies. Inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Glucksman and Loretta Brennan Glucksman, Glucksman Ireland House NYU has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned centre for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the global Irish since its founding in 1993. We're coming to you today from our home, which is an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue, here in New York City's Greenwich Village. Well, folks, another cold week behind us at this point. It feels like the winter will never end here in New York City. Some really cold temperatures again this week. But there were warm welcomes at One Washington Mews, as usual, not only in the form of our classes for people of all ages, undergrads and graduate classes and Irish language classes, but we also hosted the great Maureen Murphy, Dr. Maureen Murphy, who's a professor at Hofstra University. On Thursday night, she launched her new biography, Compassionate Stranger, Aisnith Nicholson and the Great Irish Famine. And this book is about the remarkable reformer who chronicled the Great Famine and advocated for its victims. I had the pleasure of sitting down and having a chat to Maureen. It's always wonderful to talk to such an inspiring and personable scholar. And Maureen, I'm going to share the chat with you now. She talks about the process of research for this book. It's her third installment, if you wish, on Aisnith Nicholson, this fascinating person. So for a lot of the program, we will be hearing my chat with Maureen Murphy. And I'm also going to fill in a little bit of Aisnith Nicholson's voice. I'm going to do some readings from her collection, Ireland's Welcome to the Stranger. That was actually edited by Maureen and published by the Lilliput Press back in 2002. And it basically chronicles Aisnith Nicholson's own report on her trip to Ireland. She lands in May 1844. And it's, as we will learn from Maureen, she really is pioneering or stands out as providing a really unique glimpse of Ireland in the period right before and during the Great Irish Famine. So I look forward to us bringing Aisnith Nicholson to life a little bit, and I commend Maureen in what she has done in uncovering this fascinating figure who was a little bit lost in the chronicles of history. Just to alert you as to what's coming up at Ireland House over the next week or so as well, for those of you who are interested in our public events programming, next Thursday, that is February 26th at 7 p.m, we're delighted to welcome NUI Galway's Marie-Louise Coulihan. She is going to share with us her pioneering research on women's writing and early modern Ireland, which is really a fascinating, important, and really previously underexplored area of inquiry. So if you are interested in hearing from Dr. Coulihan, do give us a call or shoot us an email as soon as possible, because, as always, our events are getting packed to capacity well in advance these days. So that's Thursday, the 26th of February at 7 p.m. And on the following Saturday, this next week is a busy week for us in that we are hosting a Saturday event at 2 p.m. That is February 28th at 2 p.m. The Irish-born sociologist and author of Finding Your Irish Roots in New York City, Joseph Buggy, will discuss genealogical resources in New York City, as well as unconventional sources in Ireland. And we are really delighted to present this event in conjunction with the New York Irish History Roundtable. Again, that is Saturday, February 28th at 2 p.m. And the person in question is Joseph Buggy, the sociologist and genealogist. Now, Tuesday, the 24th of February, this Tuesday coming, we are very excited to host the third annual Glucksmann Ireland House NYU Gala. We are honouring two wonderful Irish Americans in Peter Quinn, well-known writer, novelist, and all-round good guy who happens to be a member of the advisory board here at Glucksmann Ireland House. Peter will be presented with the Seamus Heaney Award for Arts and Letters as part of our gala annual celebration. And he will be honoured along with Mr. Ted Smith. Ted came by way of the diplomatic corps and has carved out a really impressive career for himself in the sphere of business here in New York City. Again, a well-known person in many Irish circles here in New York City, and someone we're delighted to award the Lewis L. Glucksmann Award for Leadership. It's not too late if anyone's interested in attending the event. Please do give us a call or shoot us an email. Our contact details are 212-998-3950 and ireland.house@nyu.edu if you'd like further information, or go to our website anytime, folks, for information obviously on this event, but any of the events that I mention, we have full details and they are updated regularly as things change, if they sometimes do. One more thing, folks, before we move on to Maureen Murphy and A. Smith Nicholson, I want to remind anyone who's interested in undertaking a Master's in Irish and Irish American Studies here at Glucksmann Ireland House that our priority deadline for fall 2015 applications is March 1st. Just to reiterate, we will accept applications after that, but the priority deadline is March 1st. So if you are thinking about applying for this program, do get in touch with us sooner rather than later, because March 1st, as you know, is right around the corner, and we are delighted to give you any information on that in terms of the program, curriculum, etc., etc.
Hi, I'm John Waters. I'm the director of the MA program in Irish and Irish American Studies at Glucksmann Ireland House at New York University. This is an interdisciplinary MA program encompassing the study of history, literature, music, language, and culture. We're now accepting applications for fall 2015, and generous scholarship money is available. We'd like to invite you to visit Ireland House for an MA program open house with faculty, current students, and alumni. Hope to see you there.
I'm here with Dr. Maureen O'Rourke Murphy, and it's my pleasure actually to welcome you, Maureen, to the Glucksmann Ireland House NYU Radio Hour for the first time.
Thank you.
Of course, you're not a stranger at all to us here at One Washington Mews. We're delighted to have regular contact with you. For anyone who is not familiar with Maureen, she's the Joseph L. Dion Professor of Teaching, Literacy and Leadership at Hofstra University. She is co-editor of An Irish Literature Reader, Poetry, Prose, Drama, the editor of Ireland's Welcome to the Stranger and Annals of the Famine in Ireland in 1847, 1848 and 1849, and she's the director of the New York State's Great Irish Famine Curriculum. So that brief biography, Maureen, is a nice introduction to what we're going to talk about today, which is your latest installment on a fascinating character, A. Smith Nicholson. We're talking about your new book, A. Smith Nicholson and the Great Irish Famine, Compassionate Stranger. So this is your third direct publication out of A. Smith's travels in Ireland, is that correct?
Yes, yeah. Yes. She published Ireland's Welcome to the Stranger in 1847, really to raise money for the Irish who were suffering from the famine and to raise an awareness. She wrote to the New York Tribune, she wrote to the Emancipator, the abolitionist paper, about conditions in Ireland. And so she published this book, the first book, and I did a new edition about the time of the 150th commemoration of the Great Irish Famine. Lilliput Press was game to do a new edition of Ireland's Welcome to the Stranger, 1847, and then Annals of the Famine in Ireland, 1851. So I edited those two books, but I actually have been working on this book, Miriam, for longer than you've been alive, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
so
I started this book almost 50 years ago.
Oh, so that was my next question.
Yes.
You've uncovered this woman for us in terms of her historical mark. Tell us about how you happened upon her.
Well, this is what happened. I was lucky enough in 1965 to get a Fulbright Fellowship to Ireland, and the requirement was that you work with a professor there. And while Seamus De Largy was very, very encouraging and offered great hospitality to work at the Irish Folklore Commission, he wasn't taking students. My project was the relationship between oral and written history concerning the French invasion and the Battle of Ballinamuck in 1798. Now, fortunately, Roger McHugh, professor of English in those years at UCD, had taught at Indiana while I was a student. So I went to see Roger McHugh. And in those days, it was Earlsford Terrace, climbing way up to the top of Earlsford Terrace to his office. I was a lovely, genial fellow. And I said, could you take me on? Because Professor De Largy, while he's very helpful and very welcoming, he's not taking students. And if I came aboard, that would compromise his position on this. So I said, I'm really working for my PhD for Indiana. He said, well, we have to have a project. We have to register a project if I'm going to take you on. What would you like to do? And I said, I know what I'd love to do. I'd like to look at the relationship between the travel literature in Ireland before the Great Irish Famine and pre-famine fiction. So he said, well, that would be fine. And then he leaned back in his chair and he said, Miss O'Rourke, have you ever heard of Asenath Nicholson? And I said, no. And he said, well, I don't know a lot about her, but Frank O'Connor and Sean O'Fuelon, both, of course, alive in those days, both of those people have written that she was the best commentator on Ireland, rural Ireland, before the Great Irish Famine. She might be worth a look. I said, I'll check it out. And I trotted downstairs and down Dawson Street. And in those days, Hodges Figgis was across the street on the other side. And they always had a shelf of books outside, you know, sale books. And I looked along, and there was a copy of Ireland's Welcome to the Stranger for 5 shillings, which I snapped up and went back to my flat in Ballsbridge, where I was living, and began this long relationship with Nicholson. She left not much of a trail, so they were stop and start, and I was always thinking that something was the matter with me until I read Hermione Lee saying, in every biography, there are silences and secrets. Mm. And so it was coming to terms with some of those silences and secrets. So it's taken a long time.
So essentially then the major texts that you had to work from were the published texts of
her? The two published texts, Ireland's Welcome to the Stranger and Annals of the Famine. And then there was another text, a text called Loose Papers. And my late sister-in-law, let's talk about serendipity, found a copy of it. Now, of course, it's available in reprint series, but she found a copy of it for 10 cents in Salem, Massachusetts. So I very ceremoniously handed her over a dime for it. And that gave me, it was a collection, it was called Loose Papers, a collection of her occasional writings. But it gave me an idea about the possibility of writing about her. And then, as I say, it was a slog going through a lot of primary source documents and going through what people said about her, which were very helpful, as well as what she said about things.
Yeah, I have to say, Maureen, I have in my teaching, and I'm just coming up to this period in a class I'm teaching at the moment, I often use Ireland's Welcome to the Stranger. It's a fascinating insight into pre-famine Ireland. And maybe we can touch on that, but tell me, for the benefit of our listeners who really don't know much, and actually myself, I could do with knowing a little bit more, tell me what you've reconstructed about this individual.
About her life.
Yeah.
She was born in 1792 on the frontier. The frontier was Vermont in those years. Her father and mother were real Yankees. Her father's people came off the Mayflower, and he was born in Scituate, Massachusetts, and met her mother, Martha Rice Hatch, her maiden name was Hatch, around the Worcester area. And they were brought up congregational, so there was a strong emphasis on Bible reading and personal salvation and so forth. But they were very broad. Christianity was, intolerance was very much a part of their lives. And her father said to her when she was a young girl, all the family. The Irish are a suffering people, and when they come to your door, never send them empty away. And she was marvelous about her mother. She talks about her mother, and she said when she was working during the famine, doing her one-woman famine relief, she said her mother taught her, by precept, an example. She said, you know, when you go through life, you don't always have a covered carriage. And sometimes you get a hot meal, and sometimes you get a cold meal. And sometimes people welcome you, and sometimes they repulse you. But you must keep your hands busy, keep working, and you must simply go through life and accept all that comes your way. She was trained as a teacher and was a memorable teacher in Chelsea, Vermont. I found a centenary address which says that Asenath Hatch was a remarkable teacher, a well-remembered teacher, and she left Chelsea. Her brother stayed on there. Her parents are buried there. And she went to Elizabethtown, New York, up in the Adirondacks, where she started a school. She got involved in reforming journalism, and she met a widower with three children. I think probably the older two were at her school because they lived on the same street as where Nicholson's school probably was. His name was Norman Nicholson. The little boy in the family died young, but the older two were carried on. And I think she got herself involved in prickly journalism. She was a woman who took no prisoners, and she went after the Masons because she felt that they were involved in a monopoly on financial things. Whatever happened, they show up in 1831 in New York City, which was interesting because Nicholson, Mr. Nicholson, and Norman Nicholson, was a very active politician. His partner was a lawyer who was a congressman. He had a life, he was an elected politician, a life in Elizabethtown. His family was in Elizabethtown, but for some reason, they wind up in New York in 1831, where he's listed as a merchant and she is listed as a school teacher. And then she meets Sylvester Graham of the Graham Cracker fame, and it's a conversion like St. Paul on the road to Damascus. He's a vegetarian. She immediately becomes his disciple. He also is against not only alcohol, and of course Nicholson was a temperance girl, he's also against caffeine. He's against coffee and tea, and he even believed that hot chocolate would give you the delirium tremens. So she goes cold turkey on coffee, and she talks about how she just has suffered through that, and she eventually kind of goes cold turkey, and she eventually takes a basket of apples and crackers, presumably graham crackers, and makes a trip up to see her mother, who's now about 90 years old, one tooth in her head. And then she goes along the Erie Canal, and among other places, she visits Whitesboro, New York, the Oneida Seminary, which was a hotbed of abolitionists. This seminary really kind of anticipated Oberlin. It accepted African Americans, and it was a kind of work-study place where they studied and they also worked the farm, and of course it reduced the prices. But the abolitionists sent their kids there. And then she came back and she started a series of boarding houses, these temperance boarding houses, one down on the corner of Wall Street, one over on Williams Street later on, and finally one over on Beekman Street. And these abolitionists, these boarding houses, these temperance vegetarian boarding houses, became the places where the abolitionists stayed. In fact, a man who stayed there, one of my sources, said that this place is full not only of vegetarians, Grahamites, but Garrisonites. And I was close enough, I'm just one move away from proving that the American Abolitionist Society and the New York Abolitionist Society was started, founded from her house. I know there were conversations about it in her house. I know that the Tappan brothers, who are very, very strong abolitionists, that Horace Greeley, editor of the Tribune, lived there, that Joshua Levitt, who was involved in the Armistead case, all of those people, William Howitt, all of those people lived at Nicholson's boarding house. And it was at that time that they started the New York Abolitionist Society, the American Abolitionist Society, and there were, of course, attacks on the abolitionists because of their particular point of view on social justice. While she was doing that, she did her own work in the Five Points. She went into the Five Points. She was an issue person. She wasn't an organization person. So she went into the Five Points, and she visited the poor there, and she said it was in the Five Points that she learned that the Irish were a suffering people. And she decides when she can, if she can, she will go to Ireland and personally investigate the condition of the Irish poor. Now, Nicholson disappears. This is Norman Nicholson. I find out, finally, I think he died in Canton, New York in 1839. I'm convinced he was dead in 1839 because he's read out of the congregational records, and that's what happened at death. You read out of the records. I think he just took off. I think he, you know, that he married the school teacher. He wanted a mother for his children. They come to New York. She gets involved in all of this stuff. You know, he didn't buy into abolitionists and temperance and vegetarianism. I think he was out of there. And again, that's one of those secrets, one of those silences I'm unable to figure out. But by 1842, she's listed as a widow. So we know that she's widowed in 42. And in 1844, in May, she leaves on the Brooklyn to go to Ireland, and she spends 15 months, and she walks all over Ireland. She walks through every place but County Cavan.
So, Maureen, it's literally the Five Points that is that thing that brings her in on the Irish issue.
Well, she knew from her father, mm-hmm. the Irish are a suffering people, but they're the local people. She was a woman who really believed in social justice. She had been involved in the abolitionists. It was very funny, the abolitionists split about that time because of the question of seating women on their executive council. And the Tappan brothers and the kind of right-wing Garrisonites didn't believe in women sitting, meeting behind closed doors with men. Now, Nicholson always would quote St. Paul about virtuous women stayed in the home, did what they were supposed to do. She quoted it all the time. She didn't believe it. I mean, she didn't practice it. Here she is walking around Ireland by herself. And she, by that time, was an arthritic woman of 52. Now, again, it took me 50 years to write this book. So early on, when I'm going through this with Nicholson, I thought, wow, that's really remarkable to be 52 and arthritic and off you go to walk around Ireland. Well, now I'm 74, looking back at 52 and said, ah, she's just a girl. Make a difference. So she went off. She saw that they were suffering people, and she went off. She also, for Nicholson, they were dealing with the Irish in the Five Points, dealing with a poor immigrant group, and she said that she was going to Ireland to personally investigate the conditions of the Irish poor. She wanted to know what was going on. She also employed, over the years, 9 girls from near Erlingford, County Kilkenny. And, of course, she visited those families when she was walking around Ireland herself.
So they were working in the temperance houses?
They were working, yes. They worked for her as servant girls in her boarding house.
And they were 9 girls who all came from the Erlingford area?
The Erlingford area. And I think, really, yes, near Johnstown, I think, probably, but from the Erlingford area. And she describes one of them who walks back. She's walking down to Erlingford, and they find out that she is Mrs. Nicholson. And so there's great hoo-ha, and she's brought down to the home of one of the girls, and they want to make her as comfortable as possible, and it's the middle of the summer, and she just about dies because it's so hot. They pile up the blankets on her. And the next morning, one of her girls had walked all night to come to see her, threw herself around Nicholson's neck and wept because she was so glad to see her. So she knew the Irish from those angles. She knew the Irish in their plight in the Five Points. But she had these Irish domestic servants who were wonderful young women that she admired and obviously had a very warm relationship with those women.
So how do her writings, Maureen, compare with, you know, your point of departure was Professor McHugh saying that she was the most, or that
yes.
how O'Connor
yes.
and O'Faylon had identified her as the most authentic voice of pre-famine Ireland or the famine period
yeah.
in Ireland? I imagine in the course of your research, you've done a good bit of reading of the other writers who were going
yes,
to Ireland
yes,
in that
well,
period of time. How is she differentiated from your interpretation of her writing?
She's different in the sense that she gets off the coach, and it goes into the houses, and she spends time. Remember, she's a vegetarian, a temperance lady. She's quite happy with a potato and a mug of water, and she stays with them. And, for example, just to give you one example, of people in the coaches going along the road, they'd stop in a Bianconi car and stop in a coaching station. People would come up and try to beg around the coach. But the traveler who didn't get off the coach, here these Irish were beggars, they were indolent, they were idle. Nicholson got off the coach, and she saw these fellows holding spades, almost like the fellows who shape up on the corner, hoping to get a job for the day as lawn guys or yard guys or just working on a construction site. She said the problem in Ireland was not that the Irish were lazy. They wanted work, but there wasn't work for them.
Mm.
And she makes a point early on, and she says, you know, this is a country should not have this kind of thing going on. A country with the resources of England should not have this going on. It should be work for people. She makes a point of all the conditions that we know informed the thing that turned a potato disaster into a famine. Endemic poverty. She saw it and identified it. Single source of food. Saw it and identified it. Desperate need for work and the wish for work. Substandard housing. And a land system that was not sustainable, going to smaller and smaller and smaller. So she saw those kinds of things, and she saw it sympathetically. Her work, when she writes about the famine, we're very fortunate to have the diaries and the correspondence of the Quakers who went out and to check on what was going on. And they kind of delineated what was happening. Nicholson saw the human face of it. And so she tells us the human stories behind what was happening. I'm very delighted, Miriam, when I was finishing up the book, I thought, how am I going to finish this book? And I was talking about they had made the Duloc Pass walk, the last one, at the Nicholson walk, and I thought Nicholson didn't like any attention. But she had one vanity, and her vanity was her singing voice. And she writes when she was in Killarney, walking down through the hills into Killarney, that she was singing. She loved to sing, and her favorite hymn was Majestic Sweetness Sits Enthroned, and she would be singing away. And people were hiding in the bushes listening to her sing, and she heard about it afterwards, and she reports that. And I thought, well, that's that one little vanity. And so I was able to finish the book by saying that an Irish composer, a young Irish composer, a very gifted fellow who teaches at Princeton now, Donata Dennehy, wrote a cantata for the American soprano Dawn Upshaw based on an episode from Nicholson's Annals of the Famine. And this is where I can tell you, Miriam, that this is how things differ from other accounts that we get that were not written by Nicholson. I mean, Richard Davis Webb, the Quaker printer, don't believe what you read in Colin McCann in Transatlantic. Richard Davis Webb was better than he comes out there. But Richard Davis Webb talks about what he has seen and talks about what's going on, and it's a very factual and very, you know, pass the fact check test. But Nicholson describes, for example, this episode. They're in Mayo, and an old man comes, and he has a child on his back, and he comes to get a meal. And the relieving officer says, sorry, your name isn't on the list. You have to come back. And Nicholson runs after him and gives him some money. And a few days later, he comes back. Child is gone. And now the man is kind of crawling at this point. And the man said, sorry, your name isn't on the list. You have to come back. So Nicholson chases after him again and gives him some money. And then she has to go away, and she asks, she comes back, and she says to the relieving officer, that old man, did he come back? And the relieving officer said, if he didn't, then what? That episode intrigued Donata Dennehy, so he wrote his cantata based on that episode. That's Nicholson. Nicholson talking about the human face of starvation. Mm-hmm. And he's gone from the cantata to an opera called Hunger, which had a concert premiere in St. Louis last November, and the St. Louis Opera apparently is going to do it next November in St. Louis, and they're hoping that it will go to the Barbican in London and perhaps to the Abbey or to the Cork Regional Opera. It's very interesting. The second act of the opera, they interview people. For example, they interview me about Nicholson, and I'm kind of projected above the music. And they interview Noam Chomsky and Paul Krugman, talking about the economics and famine and so forth. But the ideas really come out of Nicholson's work. Yeah. So she is extraordinary that way. So what's important about Ireland's Welcome to the Stranger is she is able to see those conditions that scholars today like Cormac O'Grath and Jim Donnelly and people like that have through their analysis of primary source documents. Christine Keneally, of course, comes to mind. They have analyzed through the primary source documents these conditions. When you read Nicholson, she's on the ground observing those conditions. Mm-hmm. She writes about it in 1847. It's not a Jeremiah, but she doesn't say, see, I told you so. But she really describes what she saw. And she writes it for people here. When she goes back to Ireland in December of 1846, she says that she's there on a divine mission. She's a bit like Harriet Tubman, Florence Nightingale. These women have a sense that it's not that they've made up their mind to do this, that they're divinely inspired, that they're called to do it. And in fact, Nicholson writes, from quoting St. Luke, if this cup could pass, but if it's not, thy will be done, what Christ says in the Garden of Gethsemane. So she goes and she feels the call to do this, And then she's in despair because she runs out of money. She doesn't have anything to help. What is she going to do? Why does God send her to Dublin if she can't help? It's one thing to go and help, and one thing if you can't help. And this is December of 46. This is just about the time that the Quakers are going to start their soup kitchen. And then a letter comes from Horace Greeley, who had lived at her boarding house, the abolitionist. He's the editor of the New York Tribune, and he sends her some money, and so she's thrilled. This gets her going again. And she talks about she's wept with gratitude. So she writes to the New York Tribune, and she describes the conditions under which she's working. And Horace Greeley here says, let's take up a collection. I will personally collect in my district, and we will all send money to Mrs. Nicholson to help the Irish poor. So this is a connection here that we have with Nicholson using her friends in the United States. Mm-hmm. She writes to Joshua Levitt, another friend who was the editor of the abolitionist paper, The Emancipator. And in her first letter to the Tribune, she does something very interesting. You know, one of the questions about the Great Irish Famine is how do you represent the suffering? And there's that question about visual representation. Now, you know, in the Great Irish Famine curriculum, we have the tree, the bush. The Irish Hunger Memorial is not representational. We don't have hungry people. It's non-representational. Other people think of along the quays in front of the customs house of our own Gillespie's figures. And they're hungry, certainly. But Nicholson describes in that first letter to the Tribune, she says, read Lamentations. And she said, she describes, she said, this is what I see. And she describes the people dying of starvation, eyes bugging out, not able to stand, the skin is turned black, vacant stare. Now, we couldn't have somebody do a sculpture of that. It would be just too overwhelming. But Nicholson, in writing, can write what she sees, and we can imagine it. It's not in our face. If you look at the pictures, for example, in the Illustrated London News, they're ragged, they're obviously very hungry, but they're not clinically starving. When we did the Great Irish Famine curriculum, you know it's a big yoke, and it's about 1,200 pages, 1,300 pages. New York State, absolutely hands-off, did not say to us, you have to do this, you have to do that. They stood, and in fact, sometimes people would write in and say, we think this is what should happen. No, no, they said absolutely freehand, except for one thing. We had one lesson about hunger, and it was going to have an illustration. They wanted to vet that illustration. They didn't want an illustration that we had a picture of, and it wasn't a grotesque one, but the child had definable ribs, rib cage. No, they said, too awful to have in the curriculum. We don't want to see those ribs. So we settled on an image, but it was the only time they came in and they said, we want to see what you're going to use as an image of hunger for school kids. And there are certain limits about which we feel, you know, certain limits are appropriate. And so it's a bit the same way. And so she brings up in this letter to the Tribune, she talks about what she sees and she wants them to be able to visualize it. And we know, I just remember during the Biafran Wars in the 60s, there were letters and letters and letters about the suffering in Biafra. One Sunday, the Times ran a photograph of the children, the Biafran children, who were, again, it wasn't clinical starvation. They were, had little, you know, they had the distended bellies, and they were obviously children who were starving. But they weren't in the last stages of starvation. But in this group of children, there was one little fellow at the end, one tiny little guy with his fists in his eyes, just weeping. That letter, whatever people wrote and said, please, please, please give money, that photograph of that tiny little fellow with his fist in his eyes, weeping, that suddenly people said, oh my God, we have to do something. So Nicholson doesn't have pictures, but she does use a clinical description. She also describes, for example, an eviction. An eviction right before Christmas Eve in 1847, not by a British landlord, by a solicitor in Dublin named Walsh, who puts about 100 families out on the hillside. And she describes that. Again, too awful for us to see visually. Mm-hmm. But that description is a heartrending description. And, of course, Walsh gets mad. He's going to sue them because he says they are besmirching his character. But Nicholson and Richard Davis Webb describe this kind of eviction. So one of the things she does is she shows their suffering. She shows the human face of suffering. And she also addresses why they're suffering. And that's where she addresses absentee landlords. She addresses unfeeling officials. She's an evangelical Protestant. Her best friend is Father Matthew, the Apostle mm-hmm. of Temperance. She understands that it is the Irish poor who help each other, and it's the priests. She talks about one, Father Conway. He invites her to a baptism, which she thinks, of course, is idolatry, but she says, he was so kind, and he said to her, I have nothing to give them. I can at least give them a kind word. She's very active and interested in the evangelical Protestant missions, but when she goes down to Dingle and goes to a school, she asks if the girls are learning to read maps, and the teacher says, they don't need to read maps. They're people of their class. They don't need to read maps. And she goes over to see the presentation sisters, and of course she's a friend of Father Matthew who would have given her the entree, and the nun says to her, our children are poor, but we don't know what God has planned for them. So what we must do is give them the best possible education. For Nicholson, you see, because she was a teacher, the schools are the litmus test mm-hmm. of the communities. And we could do a whole talk about Nicholson going from school to school and what was important and what was not important.
So is it fair to say, or is it overstating things to say that the trip to Ireland changes her, or how much of an impact does it have on her, do you think, in the totality of her life, or when she comes back to the United States?
When she comes back to the United States, and she does come back in 1852, she dies in 1855, she spends her time, according to one of the people who writes an appreciation of her after her death, she spends her time along the Brooklyn waterfront, along, now Williamsburg, of course, is very trendy, but in 1840, they were building the Atlantic docks, they were building the Atlantic basin there, and it was very, very poor Irish along there. And she spent her time working among the poor Irish there. Dies in Jersey City. I don't know, again, another silence. I don't know what happens there, but we do know that she was working among the poor. But you know, as you know, Miriam, I'm a teacher, and I think the importance of Nicholson for when I teach my students about somebody like Nicholson, is she shows what one person can do. And when she gets to Dublin and she's running her one-woman soup kitchen in the Liberties, she says, I can't save everyone, but I can save someone. Mm. And so she picks some families and she assists those families. She teaches them how to cook an Indian meal, and she makes sure that they are fed and hopes that they will then be able to help others. So I think that that's really terribly important in her. So there was great compassion, and she's just a great example.
So I didn't realize that she had been on your radar for so long, Maureen. I mean, it's fair to say that it's kind of been a labor of love for you in terms of
yes.
trying to reconstruct her life and
yes.
things like that.
Yes, yeah. And she's full of mischief in some ways. I mean, without sounding spooky, for example, she was always losing things, particularly her spectacles. And she goes to Lismore, and she's standing on the bridge in Lismore, and she gets distracted, and she goes off, and she realizes, oh my goodness, she's lost her spectacles. So, of course, I was trailing around, finding where Nicholson went and visited all the places that she went. And one day, I was standing on the bridge in Lismore with my sunglasses on. I took my sunglasses off because I was taking a photograph. And, you know, for somebody living in the United States, writing about somebody walking through Ireland, I have boxes and boxes of photographs of every place she went, because when I wanted to describe them, I was able to do that. So I took my sunglasses off. I'm taking pictures. I get in the car and driving over the hills to Cork, get to Cork and say, what did I do with my sunglasses? Left them in the same place on the bridge that Nicholson did. And I was saying, Nicholson, what a nitwit. You know, she just lost her glasses again. There it is.
Literally history repeating.
Literally history repeating.
Maureen, you've talked about Asenath's wonderful descriptions of Ireland during the famine, and I'm wondering if her commentary on the 5 points and the population there, what people are living, the conditions of people in the 5 points, is that comparable in terms of our interpretation since of life in that time as well? In other words, is she as sympathetic about the plight of the population of the 5 points as she is about the Irish
yes.
in Ireland?
Yeah. Yes, she is. In fact, when she goes to Achill Island and she runs into Reverend Dangle's Protestant missionary colony, she asks about literacy. And they say, oh no, they said these people can't read. We read the Bible to them. And she said, nonsense. She said, Irish people as old as 60 are taught to read in New York, and they're doing fine. They've learned to read. So there's that. Great sympathy on her part. And she really sees that the Irish were a suffering people when she was in the Five Points.
Mm-hmm.
It's not extensive. It was a prompt for her to go on. She had a full life with her boarding house and the abolitionists, and she was also involved with some other stuff going on at the same time. But you don't get, it's a sympathetic but not an extensive description
mm-hmm.
of the Five Points.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, listen, Maureen, it's a fascinating story. It's so nice now to, I suppose, contextualize your earlier publications related to her in terms of looking at her own life. It's more about her as a person. A. Smith Nicholson and the Great Irish Famine, Compassionate Stranger by Maureen O'Rourke Murphy. It's available from Syracuse University Press. Congratulations on putting this to bed, Maureen. Is it a sense of relief to be?
It is. I have to finish it before I die.
Right. Well, it's wonderful to have on our shelves, and thank you for coming to the Luxman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour to have a chat about it. And are there any projects in the works for you at the moment that you'd like to chat about?
Yes, well, of course, you know, as I'm involved down at number 7 State Street, the site of the Mission of Our Lady of the Rosary, and we have a website, and we have digitized 44,000 records there, and we continue to work on that database. And we have an exhibition, a permanent exhibition, which is open on Wednesday afternoons from 12 to 3 currently. And we have a traveling version, which has been in Tralee, which will open in Cavan on the 16th of April, and then we'll go to Mayo in the 22nd of June, and we'll stay there till May of 2016. And it's a good place for it to go because, at least the dipping that I've done into the records, we usually see about a quarter of any given group of selection of records as coming from County Mayo.
Mm.
So that's, we're bringing the girls home.
And these are the records of the girls who passed through?
Yes. They were, when they'd come into Ellis Island, if somebody didn't collect them by 5 o'clock, they were turned over to the mission. And first it was Patrick McCool, and then after Patrick McCool's death, Patrick McDonough. And he brought the girls, they brought the girls to the mission where they were put up. They were kept there till their families collected them, or they were put up. They were helped to go to the next destination if they're going to Chicago or going to Pittsburgh. And they found jobs for 12,000.
Wow.
Yes. In fact, I used to say to John Ridge, you know, our friend John Ridge, I used to say to John Ridge, go down and look at those books. They're so interesting. He'd say, yes, yes, I'll get down there. Then one day he called me. He said, I went down and looked at those books. Oh, I said, what? He said, I opened a book, looked down, and I saw my mother's name.
Wow.
So, and it was because they had arrived, and they called her relatives, her aunt and her cousin, and they came from Brooklyn and picked her up. But she waited there because Ellis Island was closing. They didn't want the girls to not have a place to go, so they were brought to the mission.
So literally a haven for them.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Well, it's a digitization. That means, Maureen, it's fully accessible on the internet.
It's fully
free
accessible on the internet. And the website, for those of you interested, www.watsonhouse.org. So it's www.watsonhouse.org. You can see the exhibition on it. You can dip into our 44,000 records and see any special events going on. And we'd love to hear from you, particularly if you have any family reminiscences of people who came through the mission. One of the days that we were open, a woman came through. She was from England. And she said, my mother came through here, and she came back here to marry my father.
Wow.
So we're collecting that. Those little nuggets.
Isn't it fascinating?
You know, they're such treasures.
Well, listen, Maureen, I hope it will be the first of many visits to us here on the Radio Hour, and I hope that all the readings of this wonderful installment on A. Smith Nicholson go as well as your visit to here at Luxman Ireland House, and onwards and upwards with it. Thank you so much, Gurv Mahaga.
Thank you, Tafol Shiro, as we name on Foster in the show.
Compliment that wonderful interview with Professor Maureen Murphy on A. Smith Nicholson and filling us in about the background of this very interesting lady. I thought it would be a good opportunity to hear A. Smith a little bit in her own voice. And I'm speaking about her collection of reflections on her time in Ireland in 1844-1845, as published in Ireland's Welcome to the Stranger, a publication that Maureen Murphy actually edited and had published about 15 years ago or so now. So Ireland's Welcome to the Stranger basically reflects A. Smith Nicholson's time in Ireland in 1844-45. If you had been travelling around the country at this point in time, you might have seen or heard about this extraordinary American woman walking through the Irish countryside, singing hymns, reading the Bible, and distributing religious tracts. She wore a fashionable poka coat, Indian rubber boots that pinched her feet, a velvet bonnet, a black bearskin muff, and when they were not misplaced, silver-rimmed spectacles. She recorded with some indignation that people stared at her. And this was A. Smith Hatch Nicholson, as I mentioned. Her travel journal, as Maureen has so eloquently outlined, is one of the most valuable documents we have about Ireland on the eve of the Great Famine. And indeed, in A Short History of Irish Literature by Frank O'Connor, he called her account one of the two best descriptions of the period. Maureen has really very eloquently filled us in on that, not only through the interview that I've shared with you, but also in the pages of her wonderful publication, Compassionate Stranger. So I wanted, as I said, to inject a little bit of the voice of A. Smith into this week's programme. It is such a rich period in Irish history in terms of, from the vantage point of where we are now, we know that Ireland will change hugely with the famine, the great An Chuairte Mór, the great Irish famine. And she also gives an insight into the trip to Ireland and the logistics of and her experiences of her voyage, etc., etc. So I'm going to start off by reading from the very first chapter of Ireland's Welcome to the Stranger. And in this chapter, A. Smith is describing her departure from New York. She talks about her parents a little bit, so we get a little bit of context through her own words, so to speak. She talks about the passengers on board the ship as she travels to Ireland, fascinating insights that really should cause us to pause and reflect on the lived experience of travelling across the Atlantic in the mid-19th century. And she'll also outline in this chapter her initial arrival in Ireland and some of her first experiences. I think it's rather interesting. It was in the spring of 1844, May 16th, that I stood upon the deck of the ship Brooklyn and saw the last spire of New York recede in the distance. It was the home of my childhood, the land where hopes and disappointments had ebbed and flowed, where I had looked out through smiles and tears till the last earthly tie was severed, and where the last tear was dried on the graves of those most loved. I had no more to shed. It was with a stoical indifference I heard the last farewell and took the last grasp of the hand of him who asked, "When shall we look for you home?" And then I shut myself into the narrow cabin, which was to be my parlour and bedroom during the voyage, heeding neither wind or wave or monster of the deep. It was not the rich, the honoured, or the happy I was hoping to meet. It was not their salutations or presents I was going to seek for. It was the poor and outcast. I was about to visit those who in dens and caves of the earth were forgotten by their neighbours, and who heard no kinder voices than the whistling of the winds or the screeching of some desolate owl among the mountains and crags where they had made their habitations. I was alone. Not a soul in the ship but the captain knew my name or understood my object, and leaving the command of the vessel to him, and the working of the ropes to the sailor, I betook myself to the opening of my parcels,
to ascertain what necessary supplies they contained for mind and body in a voyage like this. My boast is not that I deduce my birth from loins enthroned and rulers of the earth, but higher far my proud pretensions rise, the child of parents passed into the skies. My home education was of the most uncompromising kind. My parents were descended from the puritanical stock. They taught me that goodness alone was greatness, that in order rightly to estimate the worth of a man, his gold watch and equipage, his title and station must be deducted, that a conformity to the customs of the world, when they clashed with the sound principles of the gospel or the strictest rules of morality, was not only a sin, but meanness of spirit. My father had read little and thought much, and though somewhat orthodox, yet he cared not whether his neighbour prayed kneeling or standing, if he prayed in the true spirit, or whether the palm were in a minor or major key, or performed in common or triple time, if sung, making melody in the heart to God. He hung no Quakers, nor put any men in the corner of the church because they had a coloured skin. He rebuked sin in high places with fearlessness and forgave all personal injuries before forgiveness was asked. My mother remembered the poor and entertained strangers, hated oppression, scorned a mean act, and dealt justly by all. She taught me that in order to be healthy, I must rise early, and if I desired to take an honest breakfast with proper relish, I must earn it before eating it, that to find friends I must show myself friendly, that to live peaceably I must allow my neighbours to go out and in, drink, eat and dress when and how they liked, always avoiding putting my head into a hornet's nest if I would not be stung. And when you are sent from home, she emphatically said, conduct yourself well, and your good name will take care of itself, always remembering that a character which requires lawyers and doctors, ministers and elders to look after it, is not worth a groat. With these principles in my head, if not in my heart, I was sent into the world to make my way through good and evil report as best I could. I looked out upon the seas, the vessel was well under way, and the dizzy passengers had already begun to exclaim, "Oh dear, I am dreadfully sick." My chum now entered. We were shut in, and like or dislike, there was no alternative. Snugly packed as we were, there was no escape, and we immediately set ourselves about, as Eve's daughters are wont to do, ascertaining each other's pedigree, object, and destination. I found her to be an Irish lady, born and bred in the city of Dublin, but she had passed 5 years in the city of New York, to which she had become greatly attached. She had left her husband and 3 children to go on business to Ireland, and though she cast many a longing, lingering look back to them, yet she never forgot that she must do good unto all when opportunity presented, and she never neglected the performance of that duty when necessity required it. Her tall and noble figure, her high, open forehead, united with an unpretending though dignified manner, and the benevolence of her heart which beamed in her placid eye, made her to be an object not only of interest, but of warm attachment. Often, when she returned to the berth from some errand of kindness among the sick and distressed, have I said in my heart, who would not love such an angel of mercy? Thus was the beginning of my journey prosperous, and all anxiety for the morrow was banished by the blessings of today. Our cabin companions consisted of the widow of a clergyman with her son and daughter, who were returning from New York to England, their native country, an Irishman who had spent the last 25 years in America, a naval officer, an editor from the United States, a genuine American, and the young Irish wife of the mate on a visit to her people. These, with one exception, gave me more cause of praise than blame, and made me quite willing to balance accounts with them when we all parted. So, folks, I just wanted, as I said, to give you a snippet of Aisnip Nicholson's own voice, as documented in her book, Ireland's, or Travel Journal, I should describe it as, really, Ireland's Welcome to the Stranger. But if you'd like to find out more about this fascinating individual, do get your hands on a copy of Maureen Murphy's Compassionate Stranger, Aisnip Nicholson, and the Great Irish Famine,
Again, it's published by Syracuse University Press and really fills out a little bit more about the background of this very, very intriguing individual who has really served to enlighten us as to the life of people in Ireland on the eve of the famine and beyond. So folks, we're coming towards the end of the programme for another week. I'm Dr. Miriam Nyhan, and I want to thank you for listening to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. I'll be back again next Saturday on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, on HD Radio, on nyuirish.net/radiohour, and on irishradio.com. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with me or my co-producer, Jamie Sweeney, our email is ireland.house@nyu.edu and our phone number is 212-998-3950. If you'd like to hear this program again, please go to nyuirish.net/radiohour or to irishradio.com. Stay tuned for the Adrian Flannelly Show, up next on WBNJ 1160 AM. And for those of you listening on irishradio.com, do stay with us here until noon. Have a lovely weekend. Slán agus beannacht.